You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Uniquely curated programming by our hosts maintains an independent voice among the masses. You keep CJSF independent.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, CKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia. I'm featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we discuss how Mark Carney and establishment media's complicity in Israel's genocide in Gaza continues on The Breach Show, expose Calgary's new police dragnet on The Progress Report, collapse Doug Ford's dumb highway tunnel on the North State, and report on the rise of end-of-the-world fascism and resistance from the Global South with Naomi Klein on the Broadbent Institute's Perspectives. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by the Canadian journalism community Unrigged. Launched in November 2023, Unrigged.ca is your one-stop website highlighting the latest in socially and politically progressive journalism, podcasts, and videos from 25 publishers across the country. Unrigged features nonprofit outlets like Briar Patch Magazine in Regina, The Independent in St. John's, and the Coop de Solidarité Pivot in Montreal, and national news publishers like The Maple, Press Progress, and Ricochet, and 18 more. Check it out now at Unrigged.ca. And broadcasting since 2022, The Breach Show is a bi-weekly podcast featuring sharp commentary on politics and movements in Canada. On this excerpt from a new episode, Al Jones and Desmond Cole discuss how Prime Minister Mark Carney and the establishment media's complicity in Israel's genocidal siege on Gaza continues. Now, here's the show.
Welcome to The Breach Show, featuring sharp analysis on politics and social movements in Canada. I'm your host, Desmond Cole. As Israel's siege of the Gaza Strip continues to cause death, famine, and mass displacement, Canada is among many countries signaling discomfort with the carnage. But even as our officials shift their tone and language somewhat, words are not being followed up by concrete actions. To discuss Canada's ongoing complicity in genocide and institutional attempts to disavow responsibility for the carnage, I'm joined today by Al Jones, professor, poet, activist, and Breach contributor. Hi, Al.
Hi, Desmond.
Before we unravel a few different threads of all of this, I just want to get your general perception of how conversations about Israel's military aggression are evolving in Canada from government, from politicians, institutions, from mainstream media.
I think there's been a very decisive shift in public opinion, which is backed up by polls, right? Very much generationally, but even across, you know, what we might call, you know, the normal population has very much swung, if not to the side of Palestine, at least against what Israel is doing. And we've seen that reflected. So now a majority of Canadians disagree with what Israel is doing in Gaza, believe that, you know, there are war crimes being committed and so forth. And so what we actually are seeing now is how much our government is now out of step with the vast majority of people. So you have just ordinary people on the ground, like not lefties, not activists, not people being in the Palestine movement for a long time, just like your average person that goes to church or plays soccer at the commons or drives a bus that are like, I think it's terrible that Israel is starving those children. And our politicians still holding the line mostly on this idea that we still have to support Israel, that, you know, this is somehow still this existential battle, that we're still friends with Israel. So increasingly so, I think it's been the case throughout this whole time. But I think it's even more stark that Israel is a project of the elites. And the support for Israel is very much around how elites hold power, how settler colonialism holds power, and the imperial outposts of these Western nations. And that is increasingly out of step with how populations actually understand what's going on.
Right. I want to zoom in first on the media specifically, on how media narratives are starting to shift as, you say, popular opinion starts to shift as well and has continued to shift, really. One thing we've seen, and I think many of us anticipated, is that as the conditions on the ground in Gaza have gotten worse, the mainstream media commentaries on Israel's conduct are definitely shifting, and I have a few examples. So from the Toronto Star in an editorial from last week, I'm going to quote it. "The impulse to rid the world of Hamas, which since its inception has been dedicated to the destruction of Israel, is entirely understandable. But nothing can justify the level of civilian death and suffering that we are witnessing. Nothing can justify Israel's unrelenting violence, which, whatever its motivations, poses a mounting threat to an entire people. Violence that every day adds more weight to the allegations of genocide." So that's from a recent Toronto Star editorial from last week. This is Andrew Coyne writing last week in the Globe and Mail. He was, of course, very full-throatedly supportive of Israel's invasion when it began. Quote, "If Israel's critics were too quick to accuse it of excesses in the war's early going, its defenders seem too willing to excuse or look the other way at what is happening now, nearly 2 years on," unquote. And then referring to Israeli leaders who are also more and more calling for an end to the conflict, Coyne says, quote, "Israel, they argue, has achieved the bulk of its military objectives. Nothing of any importance is to be gained by continuing the campaign. It is not going to extinguish the last of Hamas's fighters, or not at remotely acceptable a cost. Neither will it save the remaining October 7 hostages, of whom just 20 are thought to have survived. It is time, in the immortal words of Senator George Aiken, to declare victory and get out," unquote. And then finally, Al, I know that this column from Robin Urbach, also in the Globe and Mail last week, caught your attention. So, citing shifting opinion against Israel in the United States, Urbach writes that, quote, "Mr. Netanyahu's perception might be that the game is rigged, that Israel will always be held to an impossible standard, and that the international press will never report the situation fairly. And perhaps that's true. But Israel cannot afford to play. The country, more than most, needs friends internationally. Its military wins will be ephemeral. Israel's enemies always seem to rise up, rebuild, and attack again. But Israel's reputational loss will be generational. Mr. Netanyahu has lost on this front, and badly," end of quote. So mainstream media criticism, I think it's pretty clear, including from Israel's supporters, is certainly escalating. What do you make of it, Al?
I think we see that just reading them like that, I think, gives us a good gallery of exactly how accountability can be denied while shifting position, while not acknowledging that you shifted, while also refusing to account for what made you wrong in the first place, right? So we see in all these articles, for example, the idea that, like, oh, those wacky leftists were being crazy at the beginning, but now we have to admit. And I'm like, or were we correct right after? You were refusing that we were correct, and it took you 22 months to see what everybody could see. And that's not a gloating, like, oh, we were right. It's just factual, right? Israel was talking about Amalek immediately after October 7th. They announced they were going to annex the Gaza Strip. We were hearing about human animals. None of this is news. They said they were going to starve Gaza. So none of this just emerged in the last month. This has been a 22-month project that has been carried out exactly how we were told it would be carried out. Seeing in the States a lot of this around, like, this is why you should have voted for Kamala, even though, of course, Kamala was, like, shouting down protesters and saying, I'm speaking. So all of this is, on the one hand, we see that genre of media, which is refusing to take account of what you actually backed, refusing to take any accountability, acknowledge that your outlets and yourself spread lies, deliberately did not put Palestinian voices on the air, silenced Palestinian protest, like, all the things that happened, called every protest anti-Semitic, reprinted uncritically everything from Israel, everything from pro-Israel advocacy groups, on and on and on. They've done no accounting for that, and they go, oh, no, now we're shocked. It shocks the conscience. So what does that mean if you can't even take accountability for what you did? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we see this other genre, which is the Robin Urbach style, which is that all that is wrong here isn't that Israel is committing genocide. It's just that it's bad PR. So, I mean, this is, of course, incredibly laughable, because we know that Israel commits millions of dollars to propaganda, right? And we've seen that propaganda repeated on and on all our mainstream media stations. And then Israel's problem is that they naively did not anticipate a propaganda war, is the kind of line that Robin Urbach takes. She, for example, references a UN report that explicitly says there's no systematic evidence of Hamas stealing aid, and says, despite a UN report, that Hamas systematically steals aid. So she quite literally says the opposite within the article. So throughout the article, we see continual debunked statements by Urbach, even as she claims this kind of propaganda does not exist, and then basically says the problem has been optics. And if we want to save Israel, we need to understand that seeing these starving babies, it's not that it's wrong that the babies are starving. It's wrong that it makes Israel look bad. And not even Israel, just Netanyahu. So you see these various narratives, which are all about now mouthing this kind of, oh, it's so sad, while of course holding the line on what we actually do and taking no accountability to Palestinians primarily, and then also to all the people who lost their jobs, all the people who had their reputation smeared, all the outlets that participated in firing their own journalists and running articles on people like Sarah Jama, you know, uncritically calling them anti-Semites. You know, this all happened at their outlets. And they're never going to look back at that and say we were wrong. So in some ways, I think it's more cowardly and more disgusting and more contemptible to do that than to actually be a true believer. I think there's something that's even worse about having participated in this, changing your mind as such, refusing to even acknowledge it, and then to continue on as though nothing happened, as though you were always right.
As you say, I think we're probably never going to hear from many people who excused all of this that Israel actually acted with total disregard for civilian life, not just now with things like starvation and famine being evident to the public, but well, well before, that there was nearly no plan to end this siege, that it began with no very like clear objective that could be defined, like the total elimination of Hamas, for example, not exactly a realistic objective. When, how, and where does that ever end? We don't even know now with this new talk about the entire occupation of Gaza City, like what's the purpose? When does it end? And so it sounds like you're saying, Al, that this is actually all just a little too late.
And of course, another narrative we're being sold is, well, if you say that, you're the one that doesn't care about Palestinians because you care more about being right than you do about, you know, welcoming people into the big tent. You know, and that's not the point. The point isn't being right. There is no vindication or victory in being, you know, right over the body of Palestinians. The point is, A, that we did this already. We did this with the Iraq War. And the same people that cheerleaded on the Iraq War, as we know, paid no consequences. And we know throughout history, there is never, despite one of the things I think we hold on to this idea that one day justice will come and, you know, those who were in the wrong will be exposed in this particular way. They will be in front of The Hague. They will have consequences. And then we will be somehow vindicated. And I think one of the things that's hard to live with is that we have to understand that that does not occur. Maybe in a few token cases, right? So a few lower level soldiers might get prosecuted. We saw this with Abu Ghraib, right? They prosecuted some of the lower level people while the architects of the whole thing, like Rumsfeld, got away scot-free. And this, not only do they get away scot-free, they fail upwards, right? Like they continue to be rewarded. And I think that is almost impossible for us to cope with psychologically. And so saying you did not take accountability is not about saying, like, we need to be right. It's acknowledging that you do this over and over and over again, whether it's around policing, whether it's around war, whether it's around Israel, where people are correct and the mistake they make is being correct too early. You persecute those people in real ways. This wasn't just name calling. Sarah Jama got censured by the legislature for calling for a ceasefire.
And then kicked out by her.
And then kicked out. Moxie's workers that came out and waved at the parade lost their job. People were fired. Students were expelled and suspended and disciplined. People in the States are being deported. Like, this is real consequences. Journalists lost their jobs and livelihoods. People being banned from giving speeches. They've been smeared as anti-Semites. They've lost opportunities both publicly and behind the scenes. And this has gone on and on. And that is nothing compared to the Palestinian lives that have been lost. But the same people that perpetrate all that then expect that we're supposed to hand wave it. And that this is somehow normal. And I think, so that's the point, is how do you continue to move through your life as though nothing happened, take no accountability, not even recognize, even narratively, that maybe the same media outlet you're writing this for printed lies about October 7th, and maybe you could account for that in an editorial. You were the ones that had guests on the air that spread these lies. You did that directly. And when people challenged you and wrote CBC and wrote CTV and wrote the Globe and Mail, you wrote back and told them they were wrong. So the mechanism by which this is taking place publicly is the same we saw in Iraq, it's the same we saw in Afghanistan, it's the same we see over and over again. And I think that's what's so difficult for us to come to terms with, is the very same people that did this with Iraq are doing this again with Israel, and we'll do it again 10 years, 20 years from now. And the reality is, there's nothing we will ever be able to do to hold them for account. And of course, nothing that will bring back all the lives that we've lost. And living with that, I think, is what is absolutely untenable for people. And it's what's creating in people not only rage, but, you know, legitimate psychological damage in people that have to witness this.
As a highlight from a new episode of The Breach Show, listen to the rest of the interview wherever you get your podcasts and at harbingermedianetwork.com. And find more journalism for transformation at breachmedia.ca. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Coming up next. Launching in October 2024, news criticism podcast The North State features journalist Scott Martin punching through the noise bi-weekly and tackling how news media frames issues, omits information, and pushes the status quo. Like on this recent interview of Spacing Magazine's Glenn Bowerman to discuss the political utility of Ontario Premier Doug Ford's fantastical plan to build a tunnel under the 401 highway. Now, here's Scott.
The North State is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. You know, the news is often depressing. Not just the news, but the institutions reporting the news are depressing. That's a regular facet of this show. So I'm not going to lie. It did my jaded heart good to know that when Ontario Premier Doug Ford announced his government would build a tunnel under the 401, a lot of outlets reported the facts. It would cost upwards of $90 billion. It would take decades to complete, if it could even be done. And most of all, it wouldn't solve congestion at all. In essence, it's just adding more lanes. And adding more lanes doesn't fix congestion. But it's been almost a year now since Ford announced he was looking into it. A year and a provincial election, where it became one of his campaign promises. Since then, news has reported that the government already commissioned a feasibility study and rejected it in 2021. We've learned that study said there was risk of road collapse. And we've also learned that Ford will not stop talking about it. So what can we learn from this? Today, Glenn Bowerman, journalist and host of the Spacing Radio podcast, joins me to talk about the 401 tunnel and the news framing around it. Surprisingly, the news media has done a pretty good job, but they still have some faults. And as for the tunnel, well, if you read the title of this podcast, you already know my feelings on it.
So we're going to have one level going east, underneath that, another level going west, and the bottom level with a train. That's how we're going to do it.
This is the North State. Glenn Bowerman, journalist and host of the Spacing Radio podcast. Welcome to the North State.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Glad that I could have you on to talk about this. We were going to talk about something else last year that is tangential to this conversation. But before we get into this 401 tunnel, let's update everybody on exactly how this came into the public consciousness. Doug Ford, Ontario Premier, first made public reference to building a tunnel underneath the 401 in September of 2024, and the Ministry of Transportation said at the time that this tunnel would stretch from Brampton or Mississauga on the west side of the GTA to Scarborough or Markham on the east side. I believe now they've confirmed that it's Mississauga to Scarborough. It's a wide berth. It's like, I think, 40 or 50 kilometers they're thinking of making it down there. Now, that was in September of 2024, and in February, as a lot of Ontarians know, there was a provincial election, and Ford brought it up again, promising that it would be done. You know, they would make sure that this would reduce congestion, and I'm like struggling to get this out because I'm just thinking, as I'm sure you are, about the Eglinton LRT. So this is a lot, but I mean, I guess I just want to get your reflections immediately. Like, when you first heard Doug Ford announced that he's planning to dig a tunnel underneath Highway 401.
I mean, the first time that I really heard him seriously talk about it, slash outright brag about how it was going to happen, which is not how it works when you're doing a feasibility study. Yeah, that Ford will say things during an election season it really doesn't matter if they come to fruition at all, but it's red meat to his base, and it's an emotional subject for anyone in the GTHA. Congestion is terrible. I've been stuck in it. I don't drive my own automobile, but you know, I've had to take cabs and stuff. If you are using that mode of transportation, it can be quite frustrating. You do lose, you know, hours of your life. It's an emotional thing. But the thing about Ford is that he will say things and no one will remember or criticize him years later if they don't come to fruition. They just remember that he said it. It's like the guy at your pickup basketball game that shouts Kobe before he takes every shot. Even though he's bricking most of them, everyone's just like, dang, it was cool as hell when he shouted Kobe. Like, yeah, but he airballed it. But it doesn't matter. Like, you can go back to his brother when he was the mayor with the subways thing. The people behind the Ford family, who also sometimes were behind former Mayor John Tory, they realized that, like, you can make these huge claims during an election season, and the public memory for these things is so short that it really doesn't matter if it comes true or not. Like, you can look at John Tory's smart track thing that we still sometimes pops up at city council, but, like, it's not a thing. There is no smart track. He was going to build it in 7 years. It's not happening. And this tunnel is not happening either.
So when you say this tunnel's not happening, I want to dive into that a little bit more, because I agree this tunnel is not happening, but he's hanging his hat on it in a lot of public appearances. He denied that there was risk of roadway collapse, which apparently came up in a previous study in 2021 internally that is not made public. And he seems to be just defending it at every turn. So when you say it's not going to happen, what stage do you think it will be kind of abandoned or maybe fizzle out in the public consciousness? Like, what do you think the trajectory is going
to
be there?
The timing of this feasibility study, it's supposed to come up in 2027. So he'll be starting to campaign once again, assuming he wants to continue to be the premier. So I think it's very intentional. He wants to make that election about traffic congestion and grievance politics for frustrated urban and suburbanites. That might work. It might get him reelected, but it's a generational project, the likes of which we haven't really seen proposed. I think some expert put it at a projected cost of $100 billion with a B dollars. And that's assuming it's even technically feasible, which, again, maybe we'll find out if we ever see this study that comes out in 2027. Or maybe they'll sit on it like they did the last one and like they did when they had evidence that removing bike lanes wouldn't improve congestion.
There's a lot to talk about there, and you mentioned the price tag. I've seen some experts go as high as $120 billion, but this idea to drill a tunnel under the 401, I don't know how you could say it without like cracking up. It's just so absurd to me. It would be the longest tunnel in the world. I believe the second longest one is the Channel Tunnel. I think it goes from Britain to France. And that is a project that goes under the sea and is like a partnership between two countries. And it doesn't look like it's feasible. So what are some of the other things, other than the fact that it's just really long and really expensive? Like, what other things do we need to consider when we hear 401 tunnel?
Well, it's a classic thing that Ford does, and a lot of conservatives do, where he promises on one hand that, people are going to feel the pinch less from the government, there's going to be less taxes. He always kind of circumvents his big ideas, like he's his own worst enemy in a lot of ways. So one thing I noted is he asked Prime Minister Mark Carney to pitch in on this idea when during the federal election. More recently, he's also asked Mark Carney to reduce federal income tax because he says we're being taxed to death. So, okay, you want Carney to step in and pay for this $100 billion, $120 billion wonder of the world, eighth wonder of the world, but also he's supposed to cut income tax. Like, you can't circle that square. You can't cut income tax federally while also embarking on one of the largest infrastructure projects in the history of Canada. Like, with what money?
The history of the world, really.
Yeah, history of the world, right. So, like, yeah, who's going to pay for it? You can't have both things. But again, like, it doesn't matter with Ford. Like, it's not so much the feasibility, like, if it actually comes to fruition. It's just people are like, yeah, dang, I do hate sitting in traffic. And that's all this is really a play for. It's an emotional appeal to people who are legitimately frustrated. And so, for that reason, the economics of it alone, I don't see how you can build something this expensive, this massive, and then on the other hand, reduce people's taxes. It just doesn't work that way.
Well, I think this is something that has a very strong parallel and something that is going on recently. I alluded to it earlier. I initially reached out to you to talk about a bunch of things, but one of them was Doug Ford's war on bike lanes. And it's a very similar thing. There's this talking point that bike lanes cause congestion, which isn't true from all the evidence. And he pushed through a bill, well, the PCs pushed through a bill to rip them up. And there's been further developments on that front. So there was a ruling that the Doug Ford government couldn't do that with bike lanes. So do you think that is something that plays into this directly, or is just kind of like a parallel that we should pay attention to?
I think it's more than a parallel. It's all of a piece. The anti-bike lanes thing is one of his oldest favorite dead horses to beat, despite all the evidence. But again, it's an emotional appeal. If you are stuck in traffic and you see a cyclist whiz by you in a new bike lane, fairly or unfairly, I think unfairly, you get pissed. Like, that guy seems to be like he's living on easy street, skirting all this bumper-to-bumper traffic. People rarely go the one step further and say, well, maybe I should be on a bike. But... But, oh, it's too dangerous. Well, build more bike lanes. During the bike lane thing, the transportation minister, provincially, Pravmeet Sarkaria, constantly invoked common sense. And that's an old thing that we've been hearing since the Mike Harris days and maybe further, where it's like, yeah, it sounds true. I could understand if you didn't know anything about transportation planning, if you didn't have the numbers in front of you, I could understand why you think bike lanes are making your commute longer. I could understand why you would think that building a tunnel under the 401 might solve all our traffic woes. When we have evidence to the contrary on both of these major stories, and I think that is the value of this if we're going to keep talking about it. It's not like, is this possible? Is this right or wrong? It's that we're asking the wrong questions, and it's because it's difficult to explain why these quote-unquote common sense things are actually nonsense. I think there has been great work done by some writers in all the major publications, but I'll especially shout out like people like Emma McIntosh and the Narwhal, who have taken all of these highway promises as a platform to explain a very difficult concept for some people, but it's well documented, and that's induced demand, right? That is the proven idea that if you build capacity for automobiles, it maybe lessens congestion in the short term, but almost immediately those gaps are filled. And we've seen it again and again in major cities all over the world. It's basically like a Newtonian law at this point. And so that's the value of this story. It's just like the way that people think from a common sense perspective that transportation works in cities, it's not that. And the only thing that can truly reduce congestion in cities is by limiting the use of the private automobile. And that involves things like expanding transit, expanding other options for people, and even less palatable things like congestion pricing. There are some people who will always have to drive for various reasons, but there are a lot of people that don't or could carpool and choose not to because it's inconvenient. And if you made it more inconvenient to drive one person to an automobile that could easily fit multiple people, that takes up the size on the road about like half a bus when it's just one person in a sedan. If we really look at that as solutions, it's really the only way through this congestion problem is less personal automobiles.
There has been a lot of good reporting on that. I've definitely seen some pieces in Toronto Star, even the Globe and Mail released like a comedic piece telling him that he should dig down because that's what he's doing.
I saw that, yeah. I liked the cheek of him.
Yeah, it was quite good to see, especially from somewhere like the Globe and Mail. But I think one thing that concerned me about this is, you know, we've talked about the utility of this for political reasons, but one of the reasons that I think this might go further than we expect is Ford has said that he would want to designate this tunnel as a special economic zone where they could bypass laws. Now, this has been a thing that has been in the news for plenty of reasons, like the Ring of Fire. And I think that this is something that Doug Ford and, you know, maybe his successor, if this feasibility study comes out in 2027 and Ford thinks, hey, I'm going to run for the prime minister. If this is something that happens there, I think it's going to be something we see a lot more akin to the notwithstanding clause. So what do you think the special economic zone laws have to do with this? Or is it like a red herring that we shouldn't be concerned about?
If he somehow could finance it, and he was somehow still in power by the time we actually get to shovels in the ground, that yes, technically he could do it. But there's so many layers to get to first, which is, like, physically, can we do it? And if the answer is yes, physically, like, from a construction